drive.
I can't beat the United States. That's extraordinarily frustrating. I really hate this whole petitioning process. It's brutal. It's intentionally created to keep candidates from even bothering to try to run, which is why in Kentucky we have very few people who ever try to run as anything other than a Democrat or Republican, despite the automatic built-in system bias whereby half of the functions of the Democrat and Republican Party are funded by taxpayers. On top of all of that, they also make it brutal to actually be a candidate for office and a real pain in the butt. So anyway, I don't want to go on about that. Let's get a few things knocked out here, and then I'm going to, about 10 minutes in or so, we'll do the rest of the show as a best of. And I apologize for doing the best of, but I just have too much going on to do an hour-long show tonight, and I apologize. But I do have for you some new randomly generated political rhetoric. And tonight's randomly generated political rhetoric is, when I'm elected, I'll make sure that corrupt labor unions and communists cannot make a mockery of our Bibles. I love the political rhetoric generator. Tonight's spurious correlation is not a correlation at all. It's actually an inverse correlation. We do this to show that correlation is not causation. That's the reason why we take the time to bring these up. We hammer that home over and over and over. The causation is not correlation is not causation. Tonight's random correlation is actually the inverse. So the money spent on live entertainment, excluding sports, is inversely correlated with the number of labor political action committees. So the number of political action committees run by unions is inversely proportional to the money spent on live entertainment, excluding sports. Obviously, one does not cause the other. And that is the point of showing that correlation is not causation. I had a handful of things I had lined up for tonight. Like I said, I'm just not going to be able to get to everything. But I did want to talk about a couple of things. Number one, Fancy Farm. I was at a Fancy Farm. It's the biggest political event in Kentucky, so of course we're there. And of course, the organizers were kind enough to specifically block us from participating, because that's what they tend to do. They only allow the D's and the R's to play. The Democrats and Republicans, of course, bring their busloads of people that they pay to have show up, or at least give them free transportation and whatnot. All the Democrats and Republicans that show up get a free T-shirt, too. Somewhere there's a joke about, I went to this crappy picnic where it was 107,000 degrees and all I got was this lousy T-shirt. But anyway, the point is that the major parties bust people in from every which way and everything else, and it's all kind of crazy and whatever. But the whole thing is actually a show, and this year even more so than usual. Due to security concerns, only those who were invited were allowed into the area that was actually covered, and the plebes had to sit outside of the area where they couldn't even see what was going on. It was pretty stupid, honestly. I don't know. I get really frustrated because it's all blah, blah, blah anyway. All you've got there is hardcore people chanting and doing whatever. The reality is the only advantage for a candidate to go there is that all the media is also there. And it gives you an opportunity to talk to the media and say, see, I'm here. Hi. And that's what our candidate did. Now, what's interesting is the number of media outlets who decided to actually talk to our candidate versus those that did not. We had a number of interviews. I know the Leo talked to us. I know that PJ Media, I think, was one of them. PBS spoke with our candidate. I don't know who else did or did not. There were a handful of folks, and obviously most of the folks just wanted to talk to the candidate. I, as the chair, get questioned from time to time as well, and so my piece of it is that I am finishing up the petition drive, which, by the way, is why I'm going to cut things short tonight so I can get this thing finished and off of my plate. The petition drive is a brutal process. Just as a reminder, Democrats and Republicans need two signatures to run for office. Anybody else who dares to run as anything other than a Democrat or Republican needs, for this particular race, a minimum of 5,000. And because 5,000 is a ridiculously large number of signatures, you really need more than 5,000 to be sure you're safe. At 5,000, you're talking about needing somewhere between 7,500 and 10,000 signatures. And so I can tell you that Patterson's campaign will be turning in somewhere in the neighborhood of 8,300, 8,500 signatures, something like that, somewhere in there. It's just, you know, what it is. Let's see. I don't know. The whole fancy farm thing, folks, you know, if you want to go out and support a candidate, that's great. But if you're just a lay person, if you're just a whatever, I honestly would not recommend making the trip. It's a lot of hot air, and entertainingly, there's some really good analogies there that it was hotter in Western Kentucky out there than it was at home, and one could make the joke that it's because there were so many politicians within a certain number of square miles that the air all around was inherently hotter due to all the hot air being expelled by the politicians. But it's just a joke. I mean, it's just silly. The whole thing's silly. It's all about sound bites. It's all about the TV. It's all about the media. It's media. It's a staged event. And it's pathetic. And what's most pathetic of all is the way that the whole thing is staged. The whole, I mean, it's, you know, people being bussed in, it's whatever. And it's just dumb. It's just dumb. I don't know. I don't know. But anyway, that's where it's at. And for those that are wondering, as of this very, very moment of what I know of, because there are still petitioners out working and whatnot, we have collected a total of 8,055 signatures for David Patterson for United States Senate, which based on the math and everything else, we need a target of about 8,300 to 8,400, somewhere in there. And so we're a few hundred signatures away from being done. And thank God for that, because this is a brutal, brutal process that I do not wish on anyone. So that's where I'm going to end the live portion of the show tonight. I do have the best of queued up here. There's a handful of different things that I hope you'll enjoy. But until next week, folks, tune into the other shows, of course, on the network. We're here Sunday through Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern time. You can always catch the podcast. And when we're here live, we really do enjoy your calls. So definitely tune in next week. Hopefully we'll be here live. Hopefully the petition drive will be done and my life will return to normal. But until next week, I hope you all have a good week and enjoy the Best Of show. Hey, everybody, this is going to be a Best Of show. I'm finishing up a petition drive for one of the Libertarian Party candidates, and it's a brutal process. We can talk about that some other time. But in the meantime, we did have Fancy Farm this past weekend. It's a show, like usual. It's not real. They pay people to be there, blah, blah, blah. If you've missed it the first time, we've got some good stuff lined up. I will see you all next week. All right, I'm here with Brandon Simpson. He's the author of the new book, The Libertarian Lessons of South Park. And this recording is being done ahead of time because Brandon and I's schedules were not meeting, so we compromised, met ahead of time, and pre-recorded the interview. So with no further ado, I would like to welcome Brandon to the show. And I guess start out with, what inspired you to write this book? What caused you to write this book?
First, I was going to write a book about my time in France, but every time I thought about it, I was going to write a book about how the French turned me into a libertarian. And then I thought, well, that's not going to work because people wouldn't want to read that about a book about what it's like in France. Then I started to rethink the concept. How about how the French turned me into a libertarian, specifically geared towards libertarians? And then I couldn't stretch out into a whole book, though. And I thought, well, South Park. South Park is really, really libertarian, and then I thought, why not just do a libertarian analysis of South Park, and then I can use my experience from France to drive my point further.
Can you explain to us quickly what it was in France that turned you into a libertarian, since you brought it up?
Well, there's a really, really a very large entitlement culture in France. They think they have a right to everything. And we had a lot of discussions about the differences between rights and privileges. And one thing that really shocked me about living in France was that smoking is not allowed in any businesses. And, you know, we all have this image of the French smoking everywhere, right? You can't smoke anywhere. And this is considered a conservative thing to do, to have smoking bans.
You said that you were thinking about writing the story about you turning into a libertarian and just kind of thinking about that in general, and then came upon the idea of the libertarian lessons of South Park. Kind of explain to me, you know, how you decided, and I know I've, you know, read through the book, and I haven't sat down and read it page to page yet, but I did obviously read a lot of it ahead of time. And explain to me, you know, you've got it broken down issue by issue, and I guess it would really be kind of episode by episode. So explain to us, I guess, what kind of led you down that path as far as setting the book up that way. And then also, well, I'll ask the second question when you get on with the first.
Okay, well, when I was trying to think of, like, how to approach these issues, I thought, well, it'd be easier if I do episode by episode first, then I would just take each episode and discuss each libertarian lesson in that. And some episodes only have, like, one little lesson, but in the beginning of the book, I have, like, the one about, you know, smoking bans, and that chapter has many issues, but I don't like to repeat myself in my books. That's why it's all there, but I keep on referring back to it later on.
Okay. And I guess then the question I was going to ask anyway was, what was your favorite chapter or favorite part or maybe favorite episode to write about?
I'd probably say the one called Butt Out, the one where they're, you know, picking on Rob Reiner about being anti-smoking. That was one. And then my other one was probably Margaritaville. That was the one about the economic crisis in 2008.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if I remember that particular episode of Margaritaville. The one I remember clearly as far as economics go was the Goobacks.
Oh, yeah, Goobag. That was a good one, too. And I know that when I first saw it, I thought they sounded more like conservative Republican when I first saw the episode. But when I listened to the commentary, Trey and Matt were just making fun of them. That's what they're saying. They're making fun of how all these conservatives are saying, they took our jobs.
Yeah, and, you know, they do have a way of, with their particular type of satire, you know, getting a laugh by taking things to the extreme and taking people to their extreme. Yeah, it was kind of funny where towards the end of the episode they come upon the real answer that, hey, if we make things better now, you know, people won't want to come here or whatever, and you know, we can make a better future or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they end up saying, forget that, and
yeah,
we just go back to doing what we were doing.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
It's kind of entertaining. Their comedy is definitely unique and one that is entertaining.
Another thing in that, I think I discussed, you know, the issue about, you know, how immigrants are supposedly taking people's jobs and how they think English should be the official language. And I also discussed the issue of nationality, and I think nationality is a collectivist concept, and to me that's not very libertarian. And then another thing I like to mention about, you know, these immigrants taking people's jobs, I'm thinking, are they really taking your jobs? They can't take your jobs. Only your employer can do that. And then on the issue of official languages, I mentioned that when I hear people say official language, I think they really mean mandatory language, which I think is also very anti-libertarian.
Right, and I, you know, not to deviate too far from the book, but I'm of German heritage, and from the Cincinnati, greater Cincinnati area, northern Kentucky is where I've grown up and where my family originally immigrated here from Germany. And you know, before World War II, there were something like 12 German-language newspapers. It was all German. And after World War I, there were still two of them that survived until World War II came along, and at that point, they shut down. But I guess whenever I get into a discussion about immigration with folks, one of the things I always try to point out is that we are a nation of immigrants. Basically, unless you're Native American, you're an immigrant of some sort. And even though some people came here willfully, some not, we're all immigrants. What is it that gives one person the right to say that another person can't come here so long as, and that's always kind of the big thing in the libertarian circles, is we don't want people coming here to leech off the system. We don't want them to come here just to get welfare, just to get benefits. But if somebody wants to come here and get a job and raise their family and make a better life for themselves, what's more American than that? That is the American experience, is coming from a horrible place and going for broke and making it. And that's what America was built on.
Completely agree there. I even cite Milton Friedman, who did say that. He said before 1914, immigration was good, but after 1914, immigration was suddenly bad. Before 1914, there was no welfare state, so we had good immigration.
I know there's a lot of controversy even in libertarian circles about the issue of immigration. You know, and unfortunately there's court rulings and all kinds of different things on top of it that make it infinitely more complex to actually solve that problem. But I guess the point is that, and I hope everyone can agree, and I have run into some people that don't, but if someone wants to come here with the purpose of, you know, making a better life for themselves and coming and being an American, even though they hold on to some of that cultural heritage that they once had, I mean, it's entertaining, especially in the Cincinnati area, when people start complaining about, well, they're changing our culture. And I just have to laugh because there are so many little colloquialisms with Cincinnati and the Cincinnati area in general. You know, in the Cincinnati area, when you want someone to repeat themselves, you say please, right? That's different than everywhere else in the U.S. And that's a carryover from a German slang, bitte, which means please, literally. But it was one of those things where they would say please when you would say, can you repeat yourself, please? The shorthand was please. So there's ways that German heritage has influenced the culture as well, and certainly one can't say that, you know, using the phrase please is in any way, shape, or form devastating to society. Certainly, we have Oktoberfest, we have German festivals, and those aren't bad things. They're celebrations of German cultural heritage, but they're fun, and they don't hurt anyone, and likewise, we now have certain holidays that are based around Hispanic ideas, Cinco de Mayo, although there's some controversy around whether it's really a Mexican holiday, whatever. The point is, they're enhancements to our culture. When people come to America, the society tends to keep the things that they like about a culture, right? And they lose the things over time that they don't. And that's what I really believe that the melting pot really is.
True. I agree with that. I didn't know that the please from Cincinnati came from German. I wanted to go into linguistics, and that kind of fascinates me. Another thing I like to mention is something I wish I had written in the book before, but I didn't even think about it until, you know, recently, and that is Eric Cartman, the fat little kid. You know how he says, respect my authority in several episodes? I realize that every time that Matt and Trey are insulting or satirizing an authoritarian figure, Cartman is always on their side. And I guess they're trying to say that maybe authoritarians are fat little brats, like Eric Cartman is.
Well, and I think what it really is that they're trying to say that there are certain people, and maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, sometimes I think it's a little bit too much to overanalyze what's going on there, but I really think that a lot of it has to do with there are certain people that will just naturally fall in line with a statist mindset, that there need to be rules, and the rules are good, and we need to have all these rules, and certainly I'm not an advocate for no rules at all. I mean, I'm a individual rights type of person that there's obviously rules involved in that. You don't hurt me, I don't hurt you, you know, those are rules.
Sure.
But they're very basic and very fundamental rules. I feel like that there are people, as you say, like Cartman, who tends to fall in line with every authoritarian figure in the cartoon very, very quickly and jumps right on board because he's someone that jumps on a movement and is immediately seeking the power of that movement and at the same time wants that control and that authority, which is the whole respect my authority.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. In the episode of Butt Out, he said, wow, isn't he awesome, you guys? And he's like, what? Like, he just goes around imposing his will on people. He's my idol. And, of course, you know, Kyle is usually the only voice of reason among all four of them. Stan is sometimes, but not as much as Kyle is. And I think Cartman can't stand that.
No, and I think that's why he makes fun of Kyle all the time. So, you know, it's interesting. The lessons there in the stories are very, very interesting. And certainly I think it does a service that you've documented a number of those stories in the book. I'd like to find out from you, what was kind of the strongest lesson? What was the one that was to the person that may not be a libertarian, the person that isn't really paying attention? What's the number one lesson that probably smacked people that weren't paying attention upside the head and went, yeah, that's what it is. Do you think there's one in particular that stands out?
I think there might be one, and that was, I said that a dictatorship is a tyranny of the individual over the majority, and I said a democracy is just a tyranny of the majority over the individual. And you said in your radio show last week that a democracy is just a majority pushing around the minority, and that's exactly what it is. And they think that the majority rules and that the wisdom of the crowds means that it must be right. And they're saying, no, I can't. That's not always right.
One of the things we see in the business world, and I don't know if you've seen these or not, but the demotivational posters, the ones that make fun of the motivational posters, they're absolutely hilarious. And the one demotivational poster is meetings, because none of us are as dumb as all of us. And the point there being that groupthink can often lead to something worse than maybe just bouncing an idea off of one or two individuals, right, and having a good conversation. When you start dealing with the masses, and especially when you deal with a mass that is not really in tune with any particular issue that's being debated and is just listening to the media or listening to certain outlets that are pushing views rather than just reporting on them, that you end up with a mass of people that are easily manipulated and easily convinced to give up their own rights.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. There's another point that really drove home for one person. It was a libertarian from Canada. He told me that his favorite part of the book was how I kept, you know, tying everything back to freedom of choice. That was his favorite part of the book.
And I guess that's actually a really good question. Some of the folks that have already purchased the book, the feedback you're getting, I mean, it sounds like you're getting good feedback on it. I've seen some of the reviews. They all look really good. And I read those on Amazon, the reviews there. And, you know, it looks like everything's going real well. It looks like people are enjoying the book.
That's true. I've also been reaching out to libertarian organizations across the country. I've been contacting individual state libertarian parties. I don't even remember which ones I've got. I've got, I think, Colorado, New Mexico, Alabama, Michigan, Pennsylvania now just recently contacted me. And who else? Yeah, I think I'm forgetting one. Texas. Okay. Then I'm also reaching out to international libertarian parties, such as the Libertarian Party of the United Kingdom. Even the leader of the party commented in my book. So to Canada. Oh, yeah, by the way, the Libertarian Party leader of the United Kingdom, his name is Andrew Withers. In Canada, her name is Katrina Chown. Also, since I speak French and Spanish, I've been contacting this place, too. I found one in Belgium that started up 6 months ago. His name is Patrick Smet, or Smets. He speaks French, but his last name could be either French or Dutch, because he's from Belgium, so I'm not sure which one's which. So we've got Spain on board, Germany, Mexico, Argentina, and today I found two Irish sites, and the things are called Liberal Ireland. This means classic liberal, not, you know, the modern liberal, and the other one's called Land of the Free, and it started up about 2 years ago, and it's probably the strongest libertarian Irish page there is on Facebook right now, and I think he told me they're trying to unite all the libertarian mind people under one banner.
That's always a strange and interesting feat. I know that from personal experience. But, yeah, obviously, I guess that's actually another good benefit of you being multilingual, is that you're able to reach out not just to English-speaking people, but also Spanish and French, which covers a good portion of the world, other than possibly Asia and some Eastern European countries. I think you've pretty much got it covered.
When I contacted these parties, I realized they started up after Ron Paul ran for president in 2008, or after he ran for president in 2012, and apparently he was the reason they became parties. Even Party of Reason in Germany, they're the Libertarian Party, but they call themselves the Party of Reason. They started up because of Ron Paul, and they actually have a page devoted to Ron Paul, and they translate everything he says into German. Now, as far as Asia is concerned, I couldn't find any libertarian Asian sites. I went to the Amazon China, because there's an international Amazon site, and I see how my book is doing and if it's available or not, and make sure all the title is correct, because that can be a problem when it's going international. Like, is the title correct? Because a lot of times it's not, and I had to go, hey, this isn't right. So when I went to China, this book was not even showing up, and I'm thinking they must be banning it or something.
Yeah, and, you know, that wouldn't surprise me at all. You know, really, the Asian cultures in general are very, very different than Western culture. Just a whole different approach on life in general, and that's something better suited for a philosophy class in the show. But you've got quite a reach into the Western world, I guess I should say, and that's a good thing. I hope that more people read the book. I hope that they hand it off to their South Park-loving friends that maybe aren't so political, maybe aren't really thinking about it, and I think that that can have a good long-term impact on the libertarian, small-L libertarian movement in general.
Yeah. That's why I chose South Park, because I thought South Park was much more appealing to a broader audience, because I thought I can get, you know, both libertarians and South Park fans to read this. And South Park fans in general, I think when they watch the show, they become more and more libertarian. Or maybe they watch the show because they are a libertarian, or maybe they're libertarian because they watch the show. I'm thinking it could be a little bit of both. If this book does well, I have plans to do more. And the next one will be about Star Wars.
The Libertarian Lessons of Star Wars, huh? So, well, folks, I guess if we want to see the Libertarian Lessons of Star Wars, then we need folks to go out and buy this book, The Libertarian Lessons of South Park. Tell us how we can get a copy of it.
You can go to Amazon.com and do a search for The Libertarian Lessons of South Park, or you can go to my site, libertarianforronpaul.com. There's a link on the right-hand side.
All right, well, Brandon, I want to thank you a lot for coming on the show, and I certainly appreciate it. I mean, anytime we can promote the small L libertarian message in general, that's really what why activists like myself and others are involved in all these groups, like the Libertarian Party, Campaign for Liberty, and a number of other organizations. And the more people that we can convince that we're right, the further we're going to go and the better off I think society will be as a whole when we all learn to leave each other alone. Any other parting thoughts?
One thing, I did mention that I was reaching out to small L libertarians in this book, not just big L libertarians, and I did make a distinction between that. I said I'm reaching out to small L libertarians because they reach everybody, not just the big L libertarians.
Well, good deal, and folks, check out The Libertarian Lessons of South Park. The author is Brandon Simpson, spelled exactly how it sounds, and certainly thank you for coming on the show. Again, thanks, Brandon, and folks, we'll be right back.
All right, folks, and we're back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network. We're here every Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and we do appreciate when people call in, and we do have some callers. We've got co-host Dave who joins the show, and Paul returns, so I'm going to bring them back on here. Guys, I want to talk about the McConnell-Bevin race because, you know, this has been quite a bit of media, obviously, and a lot of money, you know, a lot of outside money. And that's, you know, getting back to that $100 million that they're talking about for this race, most of the money is coming from out of state. And for that matter, in the primary, most of the money has come from out of state. I don't know. I'm interested in your all's thoughts. Or do you have any handicapping on this? Paul, let's let you go first.
Well, being a Jefferson County resident, we get a vast amount of advertising to the local media. And also being an independent, I don't have a dog in this fight, but right now I think Matt has gotten some awfully bad advice all along the way in terms of his campaign advisors. He's been just recently running some ads he actually should have started off with, and that is an ad that I'll classify as a, you know, get to know me kind of an ad. He just now started running those kinds of ads, which is amazing. You know, those kinds of ads you should run at the beginning, you know, when you launch. But he's just terribly outspent. He doesn't have the network. He has been tagged with a whole bunch of labels that he just hasn't been able to shake. I'm going to be surprised if there isn't a 20 to 30 point win by McConnell in that race. I'm going to be shocked if there isn't that, if it isn't that large.
All right, I'm writing it down. 20 to 30 points. Dave, what are your thoughts?
Honestly, my thoughts about the McConnell-Bevin race is just, I'm flabbergasted. That's the way to describe my feelings on that race. I can't believe that anybody's going to vote for McConnell. But, I mean, I know it's going to happen, right? You know, but every time I hear it and I see the numbers and everything, I'm like, what? Really?
Yeah.
And the other... Yeah, and you know, to be fair, I don't know that much about Bevin. The one thing that keeps cropping up, you know, that I see about Bevin is that McConnell attack ad about you know, Bevin's alleged you know, activity in cockfighting, right?
Right.
And so that. When every time I see that, I have the biggest belly laugh. You know, it works out to my favor. I mean, it's probably making me a little bit younger because I'm getting so many laughs, you know, about it. But I keep thinking, you know, this is an attack ad from McConnell, who, you know, is running for the position that he's been in for a while, and his allegation is that Bevin was, you know, allegedly involved in cockfighting, and that is exactly the job that McConnell has done in his position, and he's running for it again. But he's got an attack ad out negatively saying that he's, you know, that Bevin, his challenger, is involved in cockfighting.
Like, yeah,
how does this not work out in his favor with your audience?
Well, and so I actually agree 100% with both of you guys. I think Bevan had an opportunity. I think he stumbled from the gate, had slow momentum, started to pick up steam, made a mistake, momentum stopped. Then the national groups jumped in, started supporting him. He got some momentum, went to a cockfighting rally, and the momentum stopped. I think it's unfortunate for him. I know there's a lot of good people that I know personally that have been supporting Bevan. And, you know, it's nothing against them or anything that they've done. But I think you're right, Paul. I think this race is over. And I'm thinking it's a 20-point race personally.
I like Dave's point about the cockfighting comparison. Kind of reminds me of a few years ago when a statewide office holder by the name of Jack Conway decided that he was going to try to sully the reputation of Rand Paul with the Aqua Buddha thing. And we saw right. that just absolutely did not work. In fact, in many cases, I think it probably backfired on Jack. And I think that Aqua Buddha thing is going to be draped around Jack's neck in the next election cycle for the next office he's chosen to run for. So it should be fun.
Yeah, that's a whole other race. I mean, the gubernatorial race, all the executive branch stuff starts next year, so we get to do silly season all over again. Dave, did you have any prediction numbers-wise on McConnell Bevan, or do you just want to stay out of that?
Well, I'll tell you, the one thing that I do have is an extreme amount of faith in the human capability of change, to the positive. And so I'm going to say that McConnell's going to win by about 8 points.
All right. We got Dave down here at 8 points.
I have more faith in humanity than you guys do, I guess.
You have more faith in Republican primary voters, I guess, anyway. So, it just amazes me. Everybody, he's got a 60% unfavorability rating, yet he's going to be the Republican nominee, which, you know, is dangerous for Republicans, I think, because the last person to run with a 60% unfavorability rating was David Williams in the 2011 race. And surprise, surprise, he lost by about 20 points. So I don't know. It's going to be an interesting race to watch all the way through. And I hope my friends that are listening that are Bevan supporters don't think I'm doing this as a knock on Bevan. I just, you know, just my honest analysis, you know. And I would be surprised, but it would probably be a pleasant surprise, I guess, if things turn out a little differently.
First impressions aren't the most important thing. They're the only thing. At Ernie's Print Shop, we'll produce what you need to represent your company professionally. Right now, you can get 1,000 full-color business cards, 1,000 4x6 postcards, or a 3x5 banner for just $60. You choose. Check us out at erniesprintshop.com. Ernie's Print Shop. Over 50 years, one source, one solution. erniesprintshop.com. 502-969-8585.
knows? I can feel the strain as I grab another train. I ain't looking for praise. I'm starting to sink into countless days. They overload my brain, far too much to maintain. Lost
of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springsteen of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
I want to go ahead and bring Katie on. Katie, are you with us?
I am, Ken. It's great to be back on the show.
Hey, we really appreciate you coming back on the show. We've had actually a number of folks. Hemp is probably the number one topic we get asked about on the show, and I don't, you know, when I have it on every show, although I'm sure there's plenty of information, our other listeners might get a little annoyed if we turned it into the Kentucky Industrial Hemp show. but... I do think there's been a lot. I think it's been almost a year since you were on last, and I think there's been a lot of changes both at the state and federal level, and things are starting to move, and people had a lot of questions, and you and I have talked off the show about some of the things. You know, honestly, I don't know all the details, and so I wanted to get you on the show and let you explain to folks where we are at this moment with Kentucky, with the federal laws, what, you know, kind of where the laws are, and then what's happening now and where we're heading. So I guess let's start with the state. Have there been any changes to anything at the state level after we passed the industrial hemp bill?
No, actually, we have not changed anything with regard to state law, and that was kind of up for discussion. And I think it probably will help if I start from roughly last year this time when we passed the hemp bill in the Kentucky legislature. We passed the industrial hemp bill, which would allow us to regulate and grow industrial hemp for research, for commercial purposes, for whatever we need to do. And after that, you know, we kind of were in limbo for a while. We had several months pass where we felt like, all right, well, we passed a bill. Now what do we do? Nobody really was ready to move forward. The Ag Department wanted to get clarification from the federal government that if we moved forward with industrial hemp, it wasn't going to cause any legal issues for our farmers. And so we kind of were pressuring different organizations in the federal government for some kind of clarification. Rand Paul actually sat down with Attorney General Eric Holder, and you know, that's a meeting that you probably wouldn't hear about too often, but they sat down and Rand tried to convince him to give us a waiver or give us some kind of clarification and letting us know that we could legally move forward without federal intervention. And at this point, you know, we knew that on the state level, we're all good to go. We just wanted to make sure, you know, for our farmers and for our activists and individuals who wanted to get involved with industrial hemp, that nobody was going to get in trouble. So letters were sent to the Department of Justice. Letters were sent to the DEA. I mean, there was a lot of pressuring and kind of nagging going on from the state level to the federal government and requesting that they give us clarification. And we never really heard anything back. Now, we had some letters that went to representatives in different states, and we had some things that kind of gave us a little inkling that, you know, maybe we'll be okay if we just move forward with this. But what really sealed the deal was just recently during the passage of the Farm Bill, and that was just here in 2014. It either passed last month or the month before. I'm not sure exactly how long it's been. But when the federal legislature passed the Farm Bill, there was a provision inserted into that Farm Bill. It was 2 pages long. It was a very simple 2 pages. And, in fact, you can actually read those pages if you go to the if you go to Facebook, go to my website, Kentucky for Hemp. If you look up Kentucky for Hemp on Facebook and scroll down a little ways, there is a link that you can click on. It's a link to Vote Hemp's website that will allow you to see those 2 pages from the Farm Bill. Now, what that did in those 2 pages was it allowed any states that have legalized hemp on the state level to move forward with pilot projects, either through their departments of agriculture or through university, and allow those pilot projects to actually grow hemp for research purposes. Now, it's not the ultimate goal. We have not reached our ultimate goal of actually growing hemp commercially. But what that did was it allowed Kentucky, because we've already passed our legislation on the state level, our agriculture department, our commissioner of agriculture, they're in full support of this. So it allows us to actually grow hemp for a pilot project. And what we're actually going to do is grow 6 different pilot projects across the state of Kentucky, and two in eastern Kentucky, 2 in central Kentucky, and 1 in western Kentucky. And each of those pilot projects will focus on a different aspect of industrial hemp farming. So so while we have not completely legalized hemp for commercial purposes, we have at least gotten over that first hurdle of what we needed to do to actually bring some seed into the country and do some research and essentially make sure that these varieties of hemp will grow well in the United States and in Kentucky.
Okay.
So
rewinding a
little
bit.
So that's essentially where we are right now.
Okay. Well, I want to rewind a little bit. I know at the state level, before the Farm Bill was passed, there was a bit of a debate on whether we could go forward or not. I remember Agriculture Commissioner Comer said that with the Justice Department basically green-lighting, actual full-blown marijuana growing in other states and sales and whatnot, that basically greenlit us here. And then I do know that Attorney General Conway said, no, it doesn't. And so that was... boy, that's been almost a year ago, I think now, too, maybe 9 months ago during that debate. and during the limbo period. And I really think that, in my opinion, I think Conway missed a key opportunity to actually step up for the hemp movement and just say, hey, if they're going to legalize the full-blown marijuana, then certainly hemp is fine. One of the things that we talked about last week, one of the callers called in and asked about hemp, and he mentioned that the current policy for full-blown marijuana. Now we have the hemp bill or the farm bill, and the hemp is basically, at least what we've done so far, is protected there. But because it's at least currently a Department of Justice decision not to prosecute marijuana, that, you know, the next administration can come in and undo that. And in fact, there is a push by certain people. I know the House passed a bill out of the United States House that I think it's just the House that said that it was basically it was a wimpy impeachment. Basically, it was, hey, you're not enforcing the laws. You need to enforce the laws. And in particular, a number of Republicans focus on the marijuana policy. So I do think it's very important that the federal government did clarify that we can go forward with at least getting started with hemp. So I guess the next part is what's happening now? Where are we in the state of Kentucky? What's up with the pilot programs? Where are we now?
Well, right now, each of the pilot projects have been basically the teams for each project have been set up. They've selected universities that will work with each project, and they've selected what we're kind of, you know, quote-unquote calling team captains for each pilot. And so each of the pilot project's captains are working on bringing seed into the country or finding seed, acquiring seed somehow, and essentially setting up their pilot projects and laying out all the plans, because obviously this isn't something that we can just do in one day and then that's it, we're done. This is going to take us a year. I mean, it's going to take an entire growing season to grow it. It's going to take we're going to need several weeks to actually ret the stalks. We're going to need time to process. We're going to need, you know, time to do all of this. So it's a very long process. And that's kind of at the stage right now where we are. We're in the planning process of the entire pilot project. So obviously we're still a little bit early in the season for planting, and I think that each of the projects are essentially in the same boat where we're all just kind of, because the farm bill just passed so recently, we're all kind of scrambling around to get our farmers together, get our seed together, figure out how we're going to get this harvested, how we're going to get it processed, what are we going to do with the final materials when we're finished. So while there's plenty of different opportunities and different things we could do with it, it's just a bit of a rush to, you know, figure out exactly what each project is going to do. And
so – And I am I hearing, though, that you're saying that we are going to grow this year? Is that what you're saying? There will be hemp grown in Kentucky this year?
We will. We will be growing industrial hemp in Kentucky this year.
That is wonderful. Wonderful news.
Mm-hmm. And I wish, I absolutely wish that we were growing it on a large scale, but the projects are not going to be very big. The goal of these projects is to make sure that, you know, the seed that we've got, the seed that we're bringing in will grow here. You know, is it something we can use for commercial purposes? The University of Louisville is doing their project on bioremediation. So they're actually growing hemp on an industrial site where the soil has been damaged and the soil is tainted. So they're going to, you know, see how hemp actually can remediate the soil and clean it up and help to make that soil better. So each project is going to focus on different aspects of industrial hemp. There's a project that will be done, I believe it's with the University of Kentucky, that is actually going to focus on CBD research and extracting CBD the compound CBD from industrial hemp to use as a treatment for epilepsy in children. So we've got quite a bit of, you know, interesting projects going on here.
Yeah, and that is actually really interesting. It's not just a matter of will it grow, but also what can we do with it. I think that's a good thing. I think that it's not really a question of will it grow. It's going to be a question of what strains grow the best. Because, you know, Kentucky was covered in hemp at one time. So, I mean, we know it grows. I am very interested. One of the things that doesn't get talked about a lot in industrial hemp is the bioremediation, the cleaning up polluted soil with hemp. I think that's something that, that to me is extremely interesting, because that's something that, you know, today, if you go to a polluted site, you have the EPA declare it a Superfund site, you're spending millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars while the EPA takes all the soil and digs it all up and takes it somewhere and buries it in a very deep hole and then has to bring in other soil to, I mean, reclaim the land. And it's really, really expensive. And, you know, I'm as against pollution as the next person. Who's for pollution? Raise your hand. So I that it is an interesting and exciting prospect to be able to use something natural based on how hemp it is a, if I, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not a very deep-rooted plant, and that's why it's able to do a lot of the bioremediation, soil contamination cleanup. And I think that's something that holds a lot of promise as well, not just for somebody that wants a hemp shirt or, you know, hemp paper. We hear about that stuff and people are like, well, you know, there's no real market for that. But I do think that there's a real market for bioremediation, for cleaning up pollution. And the CBD, the medical stuff for kids, is a great thing. And I thought, and I don't know if you followed this or not, but I thought they were trying to pass that bill here in Kentucky as well.
Yeah, I know. I actually have not followed that bill very closely, but I know that, yeah, they are trying to pass bills with regards to using hemp as medicine.
Yeah.
I think actually several bills.
And I think it's important, again, to reiterate. I think it's important for the audience to know, to reiterate to the audience, that there's really three separate issues, right? There's industrial hemp, there's medical marijuana, and there's full-blown legalization of marijuana. And there's really three separate issues. And so it doesn't really surprise me you haven't been following the other two. Your focus has been industrial hemp. I just didn't know if you had been following it as, you know, a side or not. But we do have some other folks involved that have been following that bill, and so maybe we can bring them on in a future show as well. I guess the point is that it sounds like everything's moving forward well. Are there any concerns or any issues that you see going forward at this point?
Actually, you know, there are some issues, and for example, we don't have conventional equipment here in the United States for the most part. I mean, I'm sure there's some somewhere, but for the most part, we don't have conventional equipment that's equipped to harvest industrial hemp. You know, the stalks for industrial hemp are very tough. The fibers are very strong. So a lot of our harvesting equipment is not adequate to harvest industrial hemp, and it has to go through different modifications to get it up to par. And I think that we've overcome some of those obstacles because, you know, once we got to the point where the Ag Department said, yes, we're going to move forward with this pilot project, we actually had different groups and different organizations that kind of came out of the woodwork and said, hey, we're already growing canaf. We're already harvesting canaf. And if you've ever seen canaf growing or being harvested or processed, it looks very similar to industrial hemp. So we've got some groups that have, you know, miraculously appeared that are, you know, already capable of doing the harvesting and the processing of this. In fact, we've got, you know, different organizations that have processing equipment that can actually be used on site. So it's one of those things that, you know, as a good friend of mine always says, obstacles create opportunities. So when we have obstacles like the harvesting equipment doesn't work, or, you know, the the combine doesn't go tall enough to cut off the tops of the seed, you know, where the seeds are in the industrial hemp. It creates opportunities for companies like International Harvester or John Deere or, you know, Case to kind of step up to the plate and meet those demands that that our farmers need. So,
how cool would it be?
So yeah,
cool would it be to have a Kentucky company actually start producing the equipment to farm industrial hemp as well to harvest it? You know, that would be jobs. Which, you know, we've there's been a lot of talk about, will this have a significant impact on the economy? I think it will, and I think that it's not just the direct hemp. It is those secondary things. It's the harvesting. It's going to be warehousing. It's going to be the processing. It's going to be all those other things that aren't necessarily directly just the hemp. It's not just the farming. It's what happens afterward. And
absolutely,
I am very happy that Kentucky's kind of taken the lead on this. It's not often we can say that. And the upside of that is that it puts us in an advantage. And if we can really develop our industrial hemp marketplace here and not just growing the hemp but also building the equipment or developing whatever the processing plants or whatever – we have a real opportunity to actually have real economic benefit from something that pretty much we know will grow anywhere in Kentucky.
Absolutely. And as far as the market goes, you know, one of the things I was discussing with one of my counterparts here in the hemp movement is that, you know, hemp can be used to create plastic pellets that are essentially the same as the petroleum plastic pellets that companies use to make everything and anything out of plastic. So if you are looking for a market, just look around your house. Look at all the objects in your house that are made out of plastic, and then imagine that that object can be made out of industrial hemp with no retooling of equipment. I mean, it's exactly the same process. You're just putting a biodegradable, earth-friendly plastic into the machine as opposed to, you know, it was petroleum-based product. So,
yep.
You know, like I said, when you're looking for a, you know, market for things, look around your house. Look at all the things that are in your house that are made out of plastic. Look at your computer and your printer and your, you know, little space heater and children's toys and umbrellas and food, you know, cutlery and that kind of thing. I mean, anything you can think of, you can make out of industrial hemp.